Okay, our fourth and last case of the morning, it's still morning, is Appeal Number 14-1210, Netidose Enterprises v. Syntron Beverage Group. Mr. Falkowski?
May it please the Court, Christopher Falkowski appearing on behalf of Netidose Enterprises. This appeal is really about two things. One is the proper application of the two-pronged judicial test for standing at a TKB opposition, and the second issue being the impact of prosecution history on a standing argument at opposition. None of the cases cited by either party is directly on point here, but I do think that the Ritchie v. Simpson decision is the most illustrative.
Before you go into the case law, can we just go a little bit more into the actual harm or injury you believe your client...
Yeah, my client has been harmed, because the mark's never registered, but just having filed the mark, the appellee...
Your client is not doing any business in the United States, right?
Currently they're doing no business in the United States, correct.
And, you know, they don't have a mark here in the United States.
Well, they did file an application after the summary judgment motion. We did file an application for a supplemental register, but it was rejected for obvious reasons.
Okay.
But I do think I think it's a fair question, but the harm is that, and this gets into some of the prosecution history issues, we're not the ones, my client is not the party that started linking together different parts of the globe and different events and saying these are all connected. You know, we didn't go to the patent office and say, or the trademark office and say, look, in response to a rejection based on lack of acquired distinctiveness, saying, well, we've got this global brand all over the place. You know, clearly, you know, we should be able to get a trademark here. I mean, we've got exclusive rights all over the world. You know, we're not the ones who opened up this box of extraterritoriality. My client was in Nigeria, perfectly happy doing what they were doing. But then they got an opposition in Nigeria asserting, hey, that the appellee had U.S. trademarks, and they were trying to push them around in Nigeria. And so then my client looked into it and said, hey, they don't even have a registration in the U.S. But I will get back to all that. I want to frame the issue if I could first. And that is the original.
What's the status of that proceeding in Nigeria?
Oh, my client prevailed. It's a registered mark in Nigeria.
So again, where is the harm?
Well, there's other jurisdictions. There's other places where there's fighting, some with my client, some with other African parties in different jurisdictions.
Well, but I'm not asking you for sort of general suppositions. I'm asking
how is this for harm?
Where are we?
I expect that there will be, because now that the mark will be registered, I suspect there will be a cancellation in Nigeria. I mean, they opposed it in Nigeria. They litigated
That's a fine speculation or
well, this is, I mean, we're talking about actual assertions.
We're talking about a real interest relating to a harm that your client reasonably believes will occur.
That's correct. I think there's a couple different levels of harm. One is the harm of fraud at the trademark office, which I'm not relying exclusively on, but I think that that's not irrelevant here.
Well, how does that harm your client?
Well,
I
guess the question is, and this, you know, gets back to the Ritchie case, what is, you know, different opposition bases have different two-prong. Essentially, the application of the two-prong test depends on what basis you're opposing a mark, right? Ritchie went to the TTAB and said, hey, this is a scandalous mark. I'm opposing it. I don't have a commercial interest, whatever. The TTAB said, you don't have a commercial interest. You don't have standing. This court then said, look, you know, depending on the basis of the opposition, you have a different. You know, the two-prong test is still real interest, you know, not being an intermeddler and reasonable belief of harm, but those factors are interpreted differently. Ritchie prevailed. The harm for Ritchie was he didn't want to make a statement that spousal abuse was against public policy. And so that was the believed harm in Ritchie, and this court found that persuasive.
He was a member of the public that was within that group that expressed that harm.
Well, I mean, he wasn't a victim of. I mean, he wasn't involved in any direct or. I mean, he personally
right.
was not
but
involved
he, as,
in,
a, as, a
as an abuser of anybody.
As a member of the general public, he was found within that group that considered this mark to be harmful. And,
that's correct.
And it, but again, I'm trying to extract from what is in the record here and what is set forth in your pleading where there is harm to your client. And I'm having trouble finding
it. Sure. Well, okay. Again, so the two places where there's harm to the client is, you know, one, I think the fact that there is a fraud on the trademark office that's allowed to be essentially sanctified and blessed, I think is a harm to everybody. And I do think that the two-prong test for fraud is going to have different, should not be reduced to a two-prong test for commercial, for a competing mark, likelihood of confusion opposition. I do think that is a solid argument. But I also think...
Is it your position that, say, a citizen of France believes that a registration was obtained fraudulently? Let's say this citizen doesn't do any business anywhere in the world. It just has a sense that, you know, this mark was obtained fraudulently. Has standing to file a petition?
The law currently does not provide for that. I think that's a better alternative than saying you can't whistleblow fraud at a trademark office unless you're in business in the U.S. I think that's not the way global commerce works. I also think it's not the way you want. I mean, someone needs to protect the sanctity of the trademark office. And in this case, you have some pretty flagrant false statements. I mean, this mark was...
Let's say we disagree with both poles, right? You're trying to create opposite poles here.
Yes.
And now we're trying to figure out where do you fall inside those opposite
poles. Yes, I appreciate that, Your Honor.
Can you please get us there?
Okay, I appreciate that, Your Honor. I think the combination here of fraud, and I mean, we can get into the detail with what the various fraudulent statements were, coupled with the prosecution history of linking all these activities together. I mean, the appellee is now saying, it's outside the United States, this is irrelevant. Well, when they were trying to get the mark approved, outside the United States seemed to have a lot of relevance.
Let's go back. How is Netto's suffering?
Netto's is suffering because it's hampering. We've been involved in litigation. There's other markets that we're afraid of going into, frankly, because we don't know if this market's registered. There's every reason to believe, given their past conduct, when they didn't even have a registration, that they're going to go back into these countries and say, hey, we got a U.S. registration, and they're going to start to try to bully other companies around. I mean, they've done this. They've asserted one Syntron mark user in Europe must have been a distributor of theirs, and they sent a threatening letter from their European attorney. They made false statements about the status of their applications in Australia.
Well, if they're making all these bullying maneuvers around the world, even before they had the trademark, it seems like it doesn't matter one way or the other whether they have a registration here in the United States. They are going to try to, I don't know, suppress competition around the world by making all kinds of allegations.
But then you're saying if the fighting is going to happen regardless, then the harm is you're going to make my client fight when they have a U.S. trademark as opposed to not having a U.S. trademark. Right now we have the ability to say, look, they don't have a registration. But if the mark is registered, they will have a registration. So my client is harmed because you're arming the opposition.
How does it arm them?
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert on Nigerian trademark law. I do, however, know that the appellee, filed the opposition in Nigeria based on these allegations about having a U.S. mark
but they lost, right?
Well, they lost in that one. There's some where they may have, they successfully registered the mark in Canada. But they're the ones who introduced this thing. I mean, in other words, look, if they had never said in these statements all this global activity, all this, double bootstrapping back and forth, and my client was just a Nigerian company doing business in Africa, and they never, we wouldn't be here today. But the appellee is the entity that decided to play this double bootstrapping game. going to a different country and saying, hey, we've got U.S. rights. And the U.S. to say, hey, we've got global rights, right? And just, you know, doing whatever they can to maximize, you know, their ability to push around, you know, my clients and others, you know, they're the ones who open that door. So I'm saying don't close it now. I mean, don't let them, you know, now that they've got it. Because remember, these marks were rejected 8 times. 8 times.
Can you just turn down the volume a little bit?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Okay, please keep going.
So anyway, so...
But with a smidge.
Smidge. I appreciate the allowance
okay.
on that. So eight times the mark was rejected because it was a surname and because of no acquired distinctiveness. And to prevail, they had to make false statements about it not being a surname. They said that, you know, we're not aware of anyone involved with the company who has the surname of Cintron. And it turns out one of the owners is a musician who in an interview said, yeah, the product's named after me. I mean, they're pretty blatant false statements. And they made these statements to get it allowed. So now that, you know, we've let the appellee, you know, make these statements in order to get the register, to get the approval, and now they're saying, oh, this international stuff doesn't really matter. But it did before. And so you asked about narrow line drawing. My point would be the best way to draw the line is to say, if someone opens the door on, you know, some activity, they shouldn't be allowed to now close the door by saying, oh, that's outside the U.S., because they're the ones who open the outside the U.S. door in the first place. And I will reserve the rest of my time for a rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. Is it Mr.
Reno?
Reno? Okay, Mr. Reno, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, because it's now afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I want to focus on the real interest part of the test, because in order to bring a trademark cancellation or opposition action, you have to have a real interest, right? That's a direct and personal stake. And that real interest must relate in some way to the United States marketplace. We discussed the Ritchie case. The Ritchie case was a United States citizen who had an interest in values that existed within a certain group of the community of the general public in the United States. If, as Judge Lynn pointed out, he was a French citizen, he wouldn't have had standing. I don't believe he would have had standing. We have a similar situation here. They're attempting to challenge my client's trademark application because of a claim of fraud. But they have no interest in the United States market, and they admitted three things that I think are fatal to their standing claim. They admitted that they don't use the mark here. They admitted that they haven't applied for protection here, and they admitted...
They didn't get on the supplemental register, I thought, which was denied.
Well, that was after the summary judgment motion was decided. They filed for that. At the time, the record before the TTAB was they never used the mark, they haven't applied to use the mark, and they had no intent whatsoever of using the mark in the United States. And then they lost, and they tried to create standing by filing this application, which was later abandoned.
So is it your position that... any impact has to occur to a company, to an opposer's interests in the United States?
It has to. There has
I'm just
to
trying
be,
to imagine
right.
What if there was a company in Toronto or Vancouver,
that
and maybe there's spillover effects if some competitor has, the same trademark rights here in the United States. You're saying that Toronto company wouldn't be able to come in and file an opposition under any circumstances?
Yes.
If all of its commerce was only in the United States?
Well, yes. Unless.
What if they have a lot of customers in Buffalo?
Well, then there's an interest that's invoking the United States marketplace, invoking United States commerce, because those customers are now United States citizens. They're purchasing things from this Canadian company.
So, but what if they're doing their purchases in Toronto?
Well, that's similar to the... I believe that's similar to the Corporacion Habanos versus Rodriguez, I believe the case was. It was one of the cases that were cited where it was a Cuban cigar company. And they couldn't sell in the United States because of the embargo. But they had standing because one of the reasons they were found to have standing was they advertised in trade journals that were sold to people who live in the United States. So United States consumers would be confused because if they're purchasing Cuban cigar or cigars from this company in the United States that had a similar mark, they would think maybe they were purchasing these Cuban cigars.
The statute, so Section 13 of the Lanham Act, says any person who believes that he would be damaged by the registration, et cetera, et cetera.
Correct.
It doesn't say any person who believes he would be damaged by virtue of a U.S. activity or any person doing business in the United States. There's nothing that restricts that to the United States, correct?
There's nothing in the text of the statute, but the Lanham Act Statement of Purpose states that it regulates commerce within the control of Congress. And what they're asking is what Netados is asking the TTAB to do in this court. They're asking this court to regulate commerce that's occurring around the world that will never exist within the United States. So the Lanham Act can only regulate commerce within the control of Congress. And Congress doesn't control commerce within Nigeria or any other country they may someday end up expanding to.
So I guess going back to my fact pattern about a Toronto company, it isn't advertising in the United States, but people in Buffalo know about this Toronto company and they want to go buy their shoes or hamburgers or whatever it is over in Toronto. And then they see that someone's about to get a mark here in the United States that would confuse their Buffalo customers. Are you saying that they wouldn't have standing to oppose that trademark?
I believe under that fact
scenario. Even though they don't sell in Buffalo, they don't advertise in Buffalo.
Right. I believe under that fact scenario they would have standing because there is confusion that is occurring within the United States marketplace. There's United States citizens that are being confused by this mark. Netados hasn't alleged that United States citizens are going to be confused by the registration of this mark because of some spillover from Nigeria, which is halfway around the world.
So, as I understand it, Netados was arguing that your side is making some arguments about a distribution agreement.
Correct.
And the arguments revolving around the distribution agreement are predicated on your intellectual property rights, and you're trying to enforce your intellectual property rights. And you're making certain arguments about Netados' position within that agreement.
Correct.
And the fact now that you're about to get a U.S. trademark, doesn't that somehow implicate their position in all these litigations?
No, I don't think it changes anything because with or without the trademark, Cintron could still make the distribution agreement argument. And the rights under the distribution agreement weren't really related to United States marketplace. They were really related to Nigeria. The claim was that they were our distributor in Nigeria and that because they were our distributor in Nigeria, we were the party that actually had the rights. That was really the argument that took place in Nigeria.
Okay, so when it comes to the distribution agreement, the scope of the dispute is limited to Nigeria because that's the territory the agreement governs.
Correct. Yes. The way the distribution agreement was set up was that Cintron entered into a distribution agreement with a company called Vidozi Enterprises or something along those lines, but it was Vidozi. And Vidozi then, the way we understood it, subcontracted with Netados to distribute really were our products, or at least we thought they were distributing our products. And then Netados went and tried to register the trademark in Nigeria. And our argument was that, you know, they are essentially a subcontractor of a sub-distributor of our distributor, so those rights should belong to us. And that was really the gist of the argument that took place before the Nigerian trademark office. And so, you know, that is really limited to just Nigeria. You know, in order to have standing, the dispute should be limited to where the interest is invoked. Like, that's really our argument. And the interest here, that was the only interest that was invoked belonging to Netados, was invoked in Nigeria. In order to create standing, they made this third-party argument that TTAB said didn't create, you know, held it didn't create standing. What they argued was that they had these trading partners that had applied for trademarks in the United States that they may someday enter into a deal with. But first of all, the trading partner is the party that's the real party of interest, and that would be the party that should have filed the petition to oppose the trademarks. And second, this court has held in the Colony Foods case that you can't invoke a third party's interest. You have to have a direct personal stake. Third party interest is not a direct personal stake in the outcome. So if this court were to allow this third party argument to take hold and give standing to Netidos, what essentially would happen is we would, I think, eviscerate the standing requirement, because any party could say, well, someday I might enter into a contract with a third party that would like to distribute these products in the United States, and therefore they would then create standing. You know, I don't think that argument has any merit to it. So that's really the gist of the issue, Your Honors, is in order to have standing, you have to invoke an interest that's within the control of Congress. And Congress does not control, worldwide rights. And there's also an interesting analogy there. The TTAP is repeatedly held that a party cannot seek to oppose or cancel a trademark based off of having a world famous mark. There is no mechanism under the Lanham Act that recognizes world famous marks. In order to seek to cancel or oppose a trademark based off of a world famous mark, you have to first file an application for registration of the trademark based off of your foreign registration and have it rejected. And once that occurs, then they would have standing. And in order to do that, you have to, one of the requirements to file a trademark that way, a trademark application under that way, is to state that you have a bona fide intent to use the mark in the United States, which they can't do. So what they're really trying to do in another way is to, I think, circle around that world famous issue and claim, well, you know, they argue the world famous thing, and we can argue it here, but at least in the United States, world famous marks aren't recognized as enough to create standing. Like I said, you have to file that application.
What if, hypothetically, you know, Mexico had a rule that said anybody that can get a trademark in the United States, presumptively you can get a trademark in Mexico, and then Netidos is doing business with that same mark in Mexico, and now it's very nervous because now they can see that, you know, they believe their potential trademark rights will be disrupted in Mexico. Would they have standing then to come in and try to oppose you here in the United States?
I would say no, because, again, that's really just invoking Mexican commerce. It's not invoking United States commerce. The Lanham Act, you know, trademarks are territorial. They're not global. And the Lanham Act can only go as far as Congress's power to regulate commerce can go. And that is as far as the territories of the United States. And if there's no other questions, I surrender the rest of my time. Thank you.
To be clear, the appellant is not requesting that Congress regulate commerce outside the U.S. We're simply saying that it is permissible to have the TTAB conduct itself in such a way that factors outside the U.S. are included in what happens here. We have statutes in this country about foreign bribery practices, where if I go to some country and I bribe government officials to get a contract, there is ramifications in the United States. So the idea that this is somehow outside the bounds of congressional power or the power of the Lanham Act is not correct. I think it's very illustrative. When asked to define kind of how you would – when the appellee is asked to define how you would measure or where the impact has to be, he said it has to be confusion in the U.S. Confusion in the U.S. Why the word confusion? There was no confusion in Ritchie. Confusion is only if you're opposing a mark based on a likelihood of confusion, a competing mark. This is an example of where the appellee is reading, is essentially grabbing onto this whole different plank of jurisprudence, the competing mark, which is a different, you know, basis of opposition, and then bringing that over to where it doesn't, where it's not applicable. It wasn't, there was no confusion in Ritchie. We don't have to have confusion to oppose a mark based on a fraud. Or, and there doesn't be confusion based on surname as well. So there is that construction of requesting that there be confusion in the U.S. is contrary to Ritchie, which is the closest precedent I think we have here. And that is that for different bases of opposition, you have different, you know, the application is going to be different of those two broadcasts. And I think that that is, that's a clear result of Ritchie. I also want to point out that this issue of the distributorship agreement was actually raised in a letter from the European Council to the same entity in Europe. So it's not limited to Nigeria. It's not even limited to Africa. It is. It's not. This distribution agreement is a global framework that CBG uses, the appellee uses, to, you know, kind of push these companies around. And I also, one other factual issue, the in deposition testimony with the Vidozi Limited, one of the owners, or I'm not sure if he's the father or the son, admitted that all the direct activity of the appellee was in the U.S. and that all their IP rights in foreign countries all based on their U.S. asset, their U.S. activities. So they admitted in deposition that any IP rights they have outside of the U.S. are contingent upon the activities and the rights generated in the U.S. And so that's why, in this case, if you allow the registration to go forward, then you are, you know, arming a party that's engaged in fraudulent statements to then go around the world and, you know, kind of reignite litigation that we'd rather not, you know, undergo. But I do think that there's a way to divide the lineup that you don't have to open the door to every opposition. And I do think that the estoppel argument, the prosecution history argument, is a way to do that. I think that if someone is going to make false statements in a way that involve other parts of the world, that they should not be allowed to later deny standing to a party because some of this activities happen outside the U.S. And I think that's a very incremental, you know, non-radical way to provide justice in this case. And I, if there's no more questions, I'd
okay. Either make my thank time. You very much. Case is submitted.
All right. The Honorable Court is adjourned from day to day.